China has two distinct frontiers, a land frontier and a maritime frontier. The land frontier goes roughly from Manchuria in the northeast to Yunnan in the southwest of China. It stretches for something like 13, 14,000 miles. It's quite meandering. Some of the border is disputed, so it's rather difficult to be precise about it. It starts in the northeast on the western side of North Korea, travels up close to Vladivostok in Russia, then Khabarovsk, near Khabarovsk in the eastern provinces, and the northeastern border is between China and Russian Siberia. The border then travels west to the south of Mongolia, north of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, turns south and then east, passing round Tibet, and follows the Himalayas along to the southwestern province of Yunnan, and then along to the sea at the point where it forms the border between China and Vietnam. This frontier then separates China from Russia and from Central or Inner Asia, or in the case of the parts of the border that are close to Tibet and Yunnan, it separates China from India and Southeast Asia. Much of this border was the frontier between China and the USSR during the Cold War period. The regions on the Chinese side of the border are the ones that were known as China's Inner Asian Frontiers, popularized by Owen Latimore in his classic study of the 1940s. The shape of China and the shape of China's borders are very familiar, but we shouldn't allow ourselves to be fooled into thinking that these borders are fixed or that there is a clear separation between China and its neighbouring territories. What there is, in fact, is a zone of cultural and ethnic overlap with communities living on both sides of the border that have very close linguistic, religious and cultural ties with each other. Not surprisingly, as a result of this, large sections of the border area are contested territories. Looking at it in a more positive way, the Inner Asian frontiers have been a bridge between Chinese culture and the cultures of its Western neighbours, and there's been much borrowing in both directions over the centuries. China's maritime frontier is a little shorter, roughly 9,000 miles. Most of it is simply the coastline of the People's Republic from the northern point at which it connects with North Korea down to Vietnam. It does, however, include a number of islands which are disputed with South Korea and Japan. It also includes Taiwan and several disputed island groups in the South China Sea, notably the Xisha and Nansha. Although Chinese textbooks and official Chinese pronouncements claim that China's borders have been fixed and are more or less eternal, that is not the case. As with many international frontiers, they are the legacy of colonial expansion and empire, particularly the expansion that took place during China's Qing Dynasty, which ran from 1644 to 1911. The rulers of the Qing Dynasty were originally from Manchuria in the northeast of China, took control of the whole of China in the 17th century, then expanded the frontiers of China to include most of what is now in Mongolia, Xinjiang, or eastern Turkestan, and Tibet. So the Chinese frontiers that are taken as normal today are those that were created by the expansion of the Qing Manchu armies under the Emperor Qianlong in the 18th century. At the same time as the Qing armies were marching westward and pushing the boundaries of their empire into Central Asia, the Russian Empire was expanding eastward. And so to a large extent, the frontiers are the points where the Russian and Chinese empires and indeed armies met. Slightly later than this, in the 19th century, Japan was beginning to carve out an empire for itself, but this impinged on China's maritime frontier, not on its inner Asian frontiers. The controversy over the status of Tibet is perhaps the best known of all of these controversial boundary questions in China. In the 21st century, Beijing claims that Tibet is and always has been part of China. In Chinese, it's known as Zhongguo Xidang, Chinese Tibet, and it's rare to see Tibet mentioned in Chinese or in a Chinese source in English without the word China in front of it. The claim to Tibet is something that China feels it's extremely important to assert. Many Tibetans, both those living in Tibet and living in exile in Dharamsala in India or in other parts of the world, strongly refute this claim by China. They argue that Tibet has always been an independent state and an autonomous culture and should be given that status now. The reality, of course, is somewhat more complicated. There is no doubt that Tibet was formally and practically independent of China between 1911, when the Chinese Empire collapsed, and 1951, when the armies of the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, took control over Tibet. The position before 1911 is somewhat more complex. Tibet had been part of the Qing dynasty's empire and had been ruled indirectly for the most part, which meant that in practice Tibet was governed by Tibetan secular officials and by the Lama governing bureaucracy in the monasteries. It's this confusion and grey area which results from the indirect way that China governed its outlying territories in the Qing dynasty, which makes it extremely difficult to come to an agreement on the precise historical status of the region. Old Tibet, the areas that were governed by the Dalai Lama and the secular bureaucracy until 1951. Parts of Old Tibet were hived off and are now administered by the Chinese provinces of Qinghai, Gansu and Sichuan. And when Tibetans talk about an independent Tibet, they are in general looking at reclaiming these territories. The position of Xinjiang in the northwest of China is analogous to that of Tibet. Xinjiang is a desert and mountainous region which borders on Kazakhstan. In Chinese, it's known as the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. The Uyghurs are the main ethnic group living in Xinjiang. They're no longer the majority because there's been such a large influx of Han Chinese migrants over the years, but they have a strong historical claim to Xinjiang, and in the Uyghur language, it is usually known as Sharqi Turkestan, Eastern Turkestan, the name that many Uyghurs prefer, but which Chinese would like to ban. The conflict over Xinjiang was dormant in the 1960s and 1970s, but in the 1980s it became a live issue once again. There were demonstrations in the border regions of Xinjiang. These were demonstrations by the Uyghurs, who are Muslims, many of whom began to reactivate arguments for an independent Xinjiang, and indeed an independent Muslim Xinjiang. These demonstrations grew in size and seriousness in the 1990s, and the most significant of these were demonstrations in the city that's known in Chinese as Yining and is known in Uyghur as Hulja, which is on the northwest frontier of Xinjiang, so it's right on the borders between China and Kazakhstan. These demonstrations took place in 1995 and the largest of these in February 1997. The Uyghur demonstrators were quite clearly calling for China to withdraw its control from Xinjiang and were looking for an independent state. China suppressed these demonstrations quite ruthlessly. A campaign known as the Strike Hard campaign was launched in 1996. That is between the two sets of demonstrations in Yining. And in fact, the severity of the repression of the Strike Hard campaign accounts in part for the February 1997 demonstrations. Since 1996, there has been even stricter Chinese control over Xinjiang. Religious activities have been restricted. Mosque attendance, for example, is prohibited to members of the Chinese Communist Party or members of the local government or to under 18s. China's military presence in Xinjiang has also been increased. When China announced its support for the coalition led by the United States in what became known as the War on Terror after the attacks on Washington in September 2001, it argued that it also had terrorists in Xinjiang and used the War on Terror as a justification for its own continued repression in Xinjiang. There have been some suggestions that September 2001 marked an increase in repression in Xinjiang. There was very little increase in repression since the repression had really been quite serious, severe since 1996. Taiwan, although it's usually regarded as the result of a conflict between communists and nationalists in the 1940s, should also be viewed in terms of China's frontiers. It's an offshore island off the coast of Fujian, and it has been argued that it was never part of China in the same way that, for example, Fujian or the neighboring mainland provinces were. This argument does have a certain substance. The original inhabitants of Taiwan, those people who these days are known as the Aborigines, were Malayo-Polynesian people. And it wasn't until the 17th and 18th century that there was a large-scale migration of ethnic Chinese people from the mainland to Taiwan. In the 17th century, part of Taiwan was a base for Dutch traders, and the island was not properly incorporated into China until the 19th century. When Japan was looking to create a maritime empire to rival that of the Europeans and the Americans in the 19th century, it began its advance to the southeast along the Ryukyu Islands. Taiwan is at the end of the Ryukyu Islands, and after a war with China in 1895, Taiwan was made into a colony of Japan, and it remained a Japanese colony until 1945, when Japan was defeated at the end of the Second World War. Japanese influence is still very strong in Taiwan. Taiwanese culture shows many similarities to the culture of mainland Japan, and even the Chinese written language as used in Taiwan has borrowed simplified characters from Japan rather than from the mainland. After the Second World War, the nationalist government, defeated on the mainland, fled to Taiwan and set up its regime in Taipei, bringing with it large numbers of officials from their original government in Nanjing or Chongqing. These mainlanders became a new elite in Taiwan, and their presence and the privileges they enjoyed were resented by many native Taiwanese. The differences between the two groups are many, but the mainlanders, on the whole, were speakers of Mandarin, while the Taiwanese spoke the Fujianese language, which their migrant forefathers had brought over in the 18th and 19th centuries. Since the ending of martial law in 1987, there has been a legal and active movement for Taiwanese independence, that is, genuine formal independence, rather than the de facto independence that it has enjoyed under the nationalists since 1949. This independence movement has been led by native Taiwanese and is partly a movement against the mainlanders. One of the historical justifications for this movement is the argument that Taiwan has never really been a part of China. The DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, currently led by President Chen Shui-bian in Taiwan, has been the most successful example of an independence leader in Taiwan to date. There has also been an independence movement in Inner Mongolia, or as the activists would prefer to call it, Southern Mongolia, since the 1980s or even earlier. It is, however, a much lower profile movement than the ones in Tibet and in Xinjiang. Mongolia used to be part of the Qing Empire until 1911. It was administered in two parts, Inner Mongolia, which was known as Inner because it was closer to the capital, Peking, Beijing as we would now know it, Outer Mongolia because it was further away from Beijing. When the Qing dynasty came to an end in 1911, Mongolia, that is Outer Mongolia, broke away, formed its own government in the city that was then known as Urga and is now known as Ulaanbaatar, and to all intents and purposes became a completely independent state. the Mongolian nationalists gradually came under the influence of activists in the Russian Revolution, and in 1924 it declared itself the People's Republic of Mongolia and allied itself with the Soviet Union. Inner Mongolia remained under Chinese warlords and was incorporated into the People's Republic of China as an autonomous region in the 1950s and remains part of the People's Republic until this day. Inner Mongolian political activism has, broadly speaking, been limited to the publication of newspapers, newsletters, and the establishment of small organizations arguing for Mongolian, that is, Inner Mongolian independence. There have been demonstrations, there has been frustration about the discrimination against the Mongolian language and the spread of the Chinese language. Some activists look to a union between the former Outer and Inner Mongolia and the production of a Greater Mongolia. Others call for the establishment of an independent Southern Mongolia. On its southwestern frontiers, China also controls a part of Kashmir that is contested by both India and Pakistan. It took these territories, known as the Aksai Chin, in 1962 after a border war in which it defeated India. The conflict in Kashmir, of course, is primarily one between India and Pakistan, and although China was an ally of Pakistan during the Cold War period and had very poor relations with India, partly because of the Aksai Chin question, but also partly because of India's support for the Dalai Lama's Tibetan regime in Dharamsala. Since the end of the Cold War, India and China have found ways of decreasing the conflict between them in the Aksai Chin area, but Beijing is very unwilling to get involved in the conflict in support of either side. Maps can be very misleading. The general outline of China has been familiar to anyone who's studied the region for decades, and it's tempting to assume that these borders have always been the same and will remain the same. But as with borders, boundaries, frontiers in other parts of the world, they have changed in the past. They could change in the future. However, any such change will be firmly resisted by the current government in Beijing. Although China is run by the Chinese Communist Party, the ideology and the sentiment that underlines their thinking is not particularly Marxist or socialist. If anything, it is primarily nationalist. This is ironic given the enmity between the Chinese Communist Party and the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, which used to run Taiwan, an enmity which has lasted since the 1920s. Nevertheless, this nationalism or patriotism has struck a chord with a large part of China's population, and it's one of the factors that accounts for the Chinese Communist Party's ability to remain in power. The retention of the borders, the refusal to allow foreigners to take 1 inch of Chinese territory, and the reclamation of Chinese territory that was left outside of these borders, notably Hong Kong and Macau, and of course Taiwan, which remains outside of the People's Republic of China, are a large part of this nationalist agenda. Chinese thinkers and Chinese politicians regard China as having suffered national humiliation since the beginnings of Japanese pressure in the early 20th century, or even further back, looking at the European colonization of parts of China in the second half of the 19th century. It is part of their mission to reverse this national humiliation, and the maintenance of the present-day borders of China is one way of demonstrating that they are doing this. There are sound economic reasons why China would wish to retain many of its frontier territories. In Xinjiang, for example, but also in other areas, there are known deposits of oil and natural gas, and for a country that is developing economically as fast as China is, the ability to exploit these sources of energy would reduce their dependence on other states. Even the political wish to reverse national humiliation doesn't account for the deep feelings that many Chinese have for what they consider to be their rightful territories. There's a word to describe China that appears frequently in Chinese language descriptions of the borders. borders or the country or the polity. It's a word that is very rarely translated into English, or if it is translated, it's just translated as China. That word is Shenzhou, which translates literally as sacred territories. Many Chinese regard the territories within the current borders of China as sacred, territories that have been bequeathed to them by their ancestors, and for all of these reasons, there's a very strong feeling that these borders should not be changed.